If you do not have a validated tap card, you may be subject to penalties.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles, in mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of the South Central Rooted podcast, your favorite podcast out there. We know you have a lot of options, but this is your go-to podcast for all the information that you want to learn about the movement and the work that's being done in South Central Los Angeles. My name is Elmer Roldan. I'm one of your co-hosts for the podcast, South Central Rooted. Our conversation today is a very important one. We're going to focus on driver of disparity number four, which focuses on environmental racism. We seek to understand the impact that environmental racism has on the people that live in South Los Angeles, but more importantly, the fact that there are multiple sources of pollution that we are exposed to. People like us who live and work in South Los Angeles are exposed to multiple forms of pollution on a daily basis. And that pollution comes in multiple manners, industrial ways like auto body shops, landfills, power plants, oil rigs, poor housing quality and overcrowding conditions that our families live under. I live directly next to the 110 freeway, so I have pollution flowing through here all the time. And people in South Los Angeles also have less access to green spaces, and that includes trees growing outside in their neighborhood. So you can imagine the amount of pollution that we take in on a daily basis. South LA ranks among the top 10 most polluted census tracts in California. And today we're going to examine the history and continued impact that environmental racism has on the residents of South Los Angeles. We want to highlight how South LA community leaders have been at the forefront of the environmental justice movement. And that's what we have here today, this very exciting panel of leaders who are going to provide that context for us. I want to start by introducing Marta Dina Arguello, who is the Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility in Los Angeles. Marta Dina, if you can please say hello to our listeners and tell us a little bit about your organization and briefly explain the mission.
Certainly. Good afternoon, everybody. Physicians for Social Responsibility is a 40-year-old organization, and the Los Angeles chapter started in the mid-80s when actually a young medical student at the time, he's a therapist now, challenged his colleagues to start a chapter in Los Angeles. And originally, our organization worked on issues of nuclear weapons, and we were part of the anti-nuclear movement of the 80s. But we were also the first chapter to start looking at the role of health disparities and public health. So it was our emergency room physicians who started some of the first gun violence programs where health professionals said, you know, this is an epidemic. And so before we had published articles that talked about violence as being viral, our doctors were seeing that in the ER rooms and having a policy response. And then we were one of the first chapters to take on the issue of climate change, and we organized a large conference at UCLA. And then in 1999, when I came onto the organization, it was a critical moment in the environmental justice movement. And I, having come from a justice background and growing up in, you know, South LA and Pico Union and East Hollywood, had an understanding of how our communities are often suffering the worst health disparities. So I, you know, wanted PSRLA to not just be an environmental organization, but to really focus on justice. And so for the last 20 whatever years since I've helped create transform PSR into a partner with environmental justice organizations, and have been working in South LA to create awareness and engagement and systems change around environmental racism. And then, you know, I'm really happy to be here with this group, because a lot of the work we're going to talk about was work we did together and really helped redefine the intersection between reproductive justice and environmental justice.
Excellent. Next, we have Kayla Thomas. She is the Environmental Justice Coordinator at Black Women for Wellness. Kayla, if you could please say hello and say a few words about your organization and briefly explain your mission.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kayla Thomas, Environmental Justice Coordinator. I've been working with Black Women for Wellness now for about 6 months. I think we take pride in providing empowerment and advocacy, as well as educational resources to Black women surrounding just our general wellness, livelihood, and building better environments. My specific background, I'm currently pursuing my master's in public health with a specification in environmental epidemiology. Really interested in toxic exposures through water and air, and as well as food access. So that is my role with Black Women for Wellness.
Welcome. And we have Dr. Astrid Williams. I love saying that. Environmental and Reproductive Justice Program Manager, also with Black Women for Wellness. Dr. Williams, if you could please say hello to our listeners and tell us a little bit more about the work that your organization does.
First of all, thank you for having me here. I am Dr. Astrid Williams. I'm the program manager for Black Women for Wellness for the Environmental Justice and Reproductive Health Program. We have our program rooted in Sisters in Control to empower our community. Our focus with Black Women for Wellness is on educating and empowering Black women and girls. And we like to do that through servicing our community through direct programs that we provide through health education, policy work, organizing, and advocacy. My background is in health promotion and education. I have a master's and doctorate in it, and my emphasis is on women health issues. So obviously, I'm very passionate about the work that we do to be able to empower the communities that we serve.
Thank you for those introductions. We want to start this conversation by defining environmental racism for our listeners who may be unfamiliar with this concept. And what we want to do, more importantly, because that's the purpose of this podcast, is we want to put into context the impact of environmental issues in South Central Los Angeles. I'm going to ask Marta Dina to please kick us off by telling our listeners what environmental racism is, and how does this concept specifically affect South Central Los Angeles?
So environmental racism speaks to the pattern and practice of racialized environmental decision-making. That's a very technical way of saying that environmental laws allowed the concentration of polluting facilities in low-income communities. It allowed racist land use and planning practices to thrive. So a lot of it actually begins with redlining. So the practice of creating segregated communities where you actually, as a matter of public policy and planning, you said, well, this is, you can live here, but you can't live here. And so I'm going to give the example of Baldwin Hills and Inglewood oil fields. Though there was racially restricted covenants throughout Los Angeles. And so for many African-American people, that was the only place to buy a home, but it was on top of an oil well. It's true of many communities where those restrictions, and what happens is over the years, as things develop, as the city develops, that those racially restrictive covenants and the practice of redlining sort of keep layering over the impacts. So you have, communities like the Southeast LA cities, Vernon, Southgate, where that's where you tended to put industrial production. and also where folks of color could buy homes and live, because often the rents were more affordable. So, or you have, you know, so sometimes, you know, we used to get asked, well, what came first, the polluting facility or the community? Well, in the research that Manuel Pastor has done is the community was there and they chose to put those facilities there because the communities were more vulnerable and they thought they could fight back less. In other cases, that is the only place next to those facilities where people of color were allowed to live as a matter of public policy.
So thank you for that, Martha Dina. And as we've talked about in other episodes, the connection between environmental racism is also tied to public investment. So Kayla, I would love for you to elaborate on environmental racism and talk about the need for more infrastructure and why it is that South Los Angeles lags to other parts of Los Angeles in different forms of infrastructure, including green spaces, access to healthy food, and other forms of islands that are created where our people not only have to face the challenges of the infrastructure that's built that is contributing to pollution, but it's also been paired with a lack of investment in what is fighting that pollution.
So just to expand, I think these two touch on each other really well. I think another big thing to think about when we talk about environmental racism is the perpetuation of the environment as a traditionally white space. So a lot of times we aren't included in those conversations, and it is seen that enjoying green spaces or accessing access to nature or being in nature is something that is inherently white, which couldn't be farther from the truth. We just have Black people, communities in particular, have just been removed from and displaced from our homes and access to our nature and traditional environments. But I think that also plays a role as to why we lack that infrastructure and green space that is needed to give us positive, to experience the positive effects of our environment, is because we've been barred out of those conversations. It's been pushed and projected onto us to be a white space that has no effect on us outside to include our health impacts and just overall quality of life. We've been removed from that. So given that, I think we are not included in those conversations, which has pushed for us not to be able to have access to those infrastructures.
Great. Thank you for that. Very important elaboration. Dr. Williams, I'd love for you to touch on the health outcomes and more importantly, the disparities that are created in the county as a whole, but specifically in South Los Angeles as it pertains to infant mortality, respiratory issues, cancers. I mean, there are so many health issues that our people deal with when there's so much concentration of pollution. And if you can tell us more about, how it is that specifically children and adults as well are impacted as a result of all the pollution that they're exposed to on a daily basis.
Yes, I definitely think that there are lots of implications in terms of our health. And when we look at the racial injustice that we face here in South Los Angeles, you mentioned a lot. Just to start off with infant mortality, or backing up, talking about reproductive justice, before you can even, have a healthy pregnancy or delivery, you have to make sure that you are able to conceive. And living in some of these affected areas where they're affected by oil extraction or drilling sites where, you have fumes and gases and all the other types of toxins and elements that are out there, it can impact one's ability to be able to conceive and reproduce. effectively, whether that be through, you know, infertility, which is on the rise now, and even more so among the rise of communities of color, Black and brown individuals. And so that in itself, with infertility, impacts our communities and to be able to reproduce effectively. And so then when we get into, you know, talking about some of the childhood disparities and concerns such as, you know, asthma, if we look at air quality, you know, again, you know, what's the quality of the neighborhood that you're looking, you're living in? And so that can have impacts in respiratory issues and of course the cancers, which as we know, within women, you have breast cancer, which by and large for within the African-American or Black community, we don't have the highest numbers, but we have the highest numbers of women that are dying from the disease, breast cancer. And a lot of it is not from genetics. And so that's a misnomer or myth that most people think that, you know, it's all faced with genetics, which that can be the case. But we're seeing from studies and research that more so it's from the environment that you live in. And so that's why it's so important, you know, to have these laws and these policies and to be able to advocate for communities of color so we can reduce these health disparities.
And that is a great transition into our next portion of the conversation. And just like the other drivers of disparity that we've discussed, environmental hazards didn't just find themselves in South Los Angeles by chance. There were specific decisions that were made by public officials that turned into policies that have perpetuated or upheld environmental racism. And, you know, I love that you just touched upon misperceptions. And there's a lot of misperceptions of people of color, particularly about our involvement in the environmental movement. And it, just how untrue it is because, you know, people of color are, in fact, some of the biggest advocates when it comes to improving the conditions that are impacting our community. So I'd love for Kayla or Dr. Williams, you know, I'll start with Kayla. If you could talk about how your organization is involved in changing the harmful practices of environmental racism, and what are the specific activities that our listeners can get involved in when they reach out to you and your organization?
A lot of the work that we do, we're involved in pushing for a number of bills that will better represent communities of color, particularly when it comes to the products that we use and the toxic chemicals that are in them. We also do a lot of webinars and meetings and just general discussions with our community members about different ways for us to advocate for ourselves, our communities, for the policies that are put in place, and specifically a lot of the things that we put into our bodies. As of right now, we've done a series of just different campaigns talking about chemical exposures and personal care products, whether it be menstrual care, just what are you putting on your face, your makeup routine, and things of that nature, and bringing autonomy to those communities and how to read product labels and being aware of the different chemicals that are being put into products, as well as teaching ourselves how to make our own products and using more natural and sustainable products and ingredients and things of that nature. We also recently put up a number of gardening plots to, again, just increase the green space that we see in our communities. So that's just a short list of things that we're doing right now. I'm sure Dr. Astrid can expand on that as well.
Yes, thank you, Kayla. And so also we work in the nonprofit realm with local organizations such as STAND LA and also CHANGE to be able to, you know, combine our efforts and collectively be able to fight this battle of racial injustice and our environmental injustice, if you will. And so working with those agencies, also, as Kayla mentioned, we do have campaigns. We have a behind the chair campaign that we work with salon owners and hairstylists, because also they're heavily impacted, you know, by the toxins and the chemicals as well. So we think from the consumer aspect, but also from occupational safety. And so we provide literature and education to be able to bring awareness for these workers that are often affected and not, you know, overlooked, if you will. And so being able to provide education and resources to them. A few other things are the Taking Stock Study, Kayla alluded to. And so this is a really good program or a campaign that we are looking at the personal care products of Black and brown women in the South Los Angeles community. We're just going into our second phase where we're hosting focus groups. But in the first phase, we were able to ascertain via app usage that they could download on their phone. And over the course of the week, they would upload their personal care products and also household products that they use. So we can see from our lab results what are some of those elements that are in there in terms of chemicals. And so those are some of the things that we're working on through Black Women for Wellness to, you know, move the needle in the trajectory in terms of environmental justice.
I wanted to add, you know, one of the projects that we are co-leading along with Strategic Concepts in Organizing and Political Education, or SCOPE, and the Watts Clean Air Task Force, is that through our collective advocacy of many groups in South LA, South Los Angeles was selected to receive a community air improvement plan through this bill that was passed called AB 617, which selects communities for specific actions to reduce emissions and improve community health. So we did a lot of advocacy, got South LA selected, and now the three of our organizations are co-leading a community process over the next 18 months where we have a community steering committee made up of residents and organizations and experts who live and work in South LA and a couple of businesses. And we'll be developing plans to figure out how to reduce emissions. And some of the things that the communities have brought, you know, the last few meetings have been about what are the main air quality concerns. And so, you know, auto body shops, metal manufacturers, dry cleaners, the freeways, bus idling, the increased traffic from the stadiums, and even some of the increased traffic around the airports. The communities have come to us and said, these are the things we want you to work on, and we want the air to be improved by looking at these particular sectors. So we're really excited. If folks are interested, that they can contact PSR or SCOPE to find out more when those community meetings are. And it's a great opportunity for communities to get involved. And we're going to need a lot of advocacy to get a plan that's actually meaningful. And the oil wells are included. And so it's you know, it's a lot of resources are going to be coming into South LA from the Air District to make that happen. And we want to make sure that it's effective.
You just said something that made me think about how these businesses operate because they're allowed to operate in the community, and there are policies that uphold environmental harm. Can you touch upon that and maybe point to specific policies that in fact allow environmental racism to exist and be upheld in our neighborhoods?
Lots of examples. I think the oil drilling example is so glaring. When you see photos of Los Angeles 100 years ago, and you see the beaches of Santa Monica and the South Bay, like Manhattan Beach area and those areas, not Manhattan Beach, I got that wrong, but certainly you know, from Will Rogers on down, covered in derricks, the entire beach covered in oil derricks. Well, that went away, right? We stopped drilling on that side of town and continued to drill on our side of town in South LA. So a group of youth in South LA actually sued for unequal protection under CEQA law and won. So there was, you know, the court sided with children who sued the city of Los Angeles, saying they were not getting the same kind of protections that kids in Beverly Hills were, where the buffers were longer. So they even though they continue to drill for oil and it's bad for everyone, still places like the West Side and Beverly Hills had more protections. And that's a perfect example of why wouldn't you protect everybody? Why do you, you know, so that's one example. I think the others, you know, the refineries are a problem in the you know, on the, in the South Bay, but the, you know, again, low income people continue to live around that community. And it is really hard to push back on those policies. The freeways were constructed and cut through our communities, right? And there's a relationship between the formation of a lot of the gangs in Los Angeles and how we cut up neighborhoods with the freeways, right? They didn't put those freeways on the West Side. There's still not a freeway that really goes through Beverly Hills. So, well, there isn't one that goes through Beverly Hills, right? So, and, you know, and the fact is that people in Watts live 17 years less than people in Brentwood. That, I think, says, you know, a lot of, I mean, that really encapsulates what environmental racism is and what health disparity is. Those two are so into, you know, so tied together.
I'm going to talk about power building as a solution, because as you all have touched upon, there are different elements of organizing that contribute to pushing back, you know, to these environmental challenges that our community faces. So I'd love to talk about how South LA community members continue to be at the forefront of this work, and more specifically, how community residents can get involved to reclaim a healthy and safer South Los Angeles. And I'll start with Kayla. I'd love for you to share why environmental racism is an issue that is important and should matter to all of us, and why we should get involved in changing these racist policies that we've all been talking about here.
Environmental racism matters because it's our built environment. And when we say built environment, it's the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, the products that we buy and choose to put on our bodies. It's our access to the grocery store that we choose to go to every day. It's all aspects of our lives. I think once we reframe our definition of environment to fit that, we understand that this is more than integral to our livelihoods of not only ourselves, but our communities and our futures. And I think it's also important to note that a lot of these things, as we've talked about through this podcast, they don't fall on us. There's a lot of bigger policies, big industries that impact, have external impact on our day-to-day. But in taking our power back, I think is educating ourselves to reframe and rework our definition of environment to that it does involve us and it does have impact to us, and we deserve and have a right to have healthy water and have access to grocery stores and safe environments for us to thrive in with green spaces. And I think once we understand that, and I think that really fuels for us to push for those changes.
Thank you for that. I have a question that might be a sensitive topic, but I'd love for Martha Dina and Dr. Williams and Kayla, if you all feel comfortable talking about this. That is, this is the idea that people need to work and people need jobs. So how do we balance people's needs for work, because there are jobs that are happening at these locations, with the fact that the consequences of the industries that these workers are involved in are causing such a big harm, not only to the people in the communities, but the environment as a whole.
I think it's also the workers themselves, right, that are often exposed. So we often talk about sort of reimagining the economy. If we're actually going to address systemic racism and climate and all of its impacts, right? I should say environmental justice in a broad sense, right? And how we achieve that. I think we have to shift the economy to from an extractive one to a care-based one. And, you know, we've been, you know, talking with SEIU and other groups who are at the core of what a caring economy looks like, how we take care of our most vulnerable. And so I think that we need to reimagine that. We also have to figure out alternatives. So Dr. Williams from Black Women for Wellness and PSR, we're part of a coalition that's, you know, members of the steel workers are part of, and members of the Communication Workers of America are part of, and that, you know, breast cancer advocates are part of, which is called Californians for a Healthy and Green Economy. And, you know, we're over a 10-year-old coalition that's been working about and really trying to bring science as a tool for innovation to figure out how to make things safer, right? And how to change the way we regulate things so that we're not putting things onto the market that aren't safe. So, and I would say that there's probably a lot of innovation and entrepreneurship in our communities to bring those safer products to market. And that is something I think that young folks who are still in high school and in college and thinking about degrees in science and green chemistry, we need those concepts in our communities so that as the green chemists think of the next new safe product, that in there, they're thinking about the justice molecule. What's the justice part of it, right? Because often you don't think about it. Places like auto body shops, I'm going to talk too much because it's my favorite topic, sorry. Auto body shops, we can actually work with the workers and the owners to figure out alternative products and alternative processes that remove remove some of the air that they're, the toxic contaminants that they're putting into the community, but it makes it safer and healthier for them to work there because many of them are working with neurotoxins and other chemicals that are making them ill from occupational exposure. We often just think of wind and solar as the alternatives, but there's so many ways to think of the alternative. Cleaning products, right? We train women how to use safer cleaning products. Well, they're old-fashioned things like vinegar and baking soda. So it's not always something new. It's about remembering the things that we used to use. I'll stop because I can't talk too much about this.
Excellent.
Thank you, Martha, Dina. And I would just add on to that. Yes, it's so important to make sure that we think about the workers themselves. As I alluded to earlier, you have the salon owners and workers and the, you know, nail and the hair salons that are exposed to this on a day-to-day basis. And so we may go in there, you know, to personal care, whether it's your nails or your hair, to get done once every, you know, 2 to 3 weeks or even a month, right? But they're exposed to these, you know, toxins and chemicals on a day-to-day basis. And so making sure that you have proper ventilation, you know, proper tools, looking at the, you know, types of products that they're using. Can we look at more cleaner products that they're having that are free from pests, you know, parabens and, you know, other types of, you know, endocrine disruptors, excuse me, as we were talking about going back to the reproductive health. And so those are some key things to think about, I think, that are critical when we're working with them because they're trying to provide a livelihood for their families as well. And so we want to make sure that it's just for them as they're exposed to this on a day-to-day basis.
We're also finding that there's probably a lot more jobs in cleaning up the mess we've already made. So we should figure out safer ways to clean our soil because right now we sort of dig and burn and haul it. But if we could do that, then we'd actually have safer places to create green space in South LA. But that's also create jobs. We've got a bunch of oil wells and oil and gas infrastructure underneath Los Angeles. Cleaning that up could be create lots of new jobs. We still have water systems in Los Angeles and throughout the country that have lead in them. Imagine, you know, there is a company we work with that creates a lead-safe alloy. imagine the number of jobs if we actually made a commitment to say no more lead in water, right? So there are jobs and they are the jobs of the future, and it should be, but you know, we end up getting in these fights over jobs versus the environment. And then the workers and communities aren't served by those arguments and those policy fights.
I'm going to ask if you can share resources for people that want to know more about environmental racism. Either readings that you may have, websites, YouTube videos. I mean, where can people go and learn more about this topic? I'm gonna start with Kayla.
So if you visit our personal website, bwwla.org, we have a number of links introducing people into what is the Green New Deal, what is quote unquote a just transition, as well as a few other resources and videos that we've done over time. We've recorded a few of our Curls in Conversation videos where we've interviewed different hairstylists about just safer hairstyling practices. We have our chem cards, which has a list of chemicals to avoid when you're shopping for your personal care products. There's always a couple books that I like to highlight as well to introduce into the Sacrifice Zones, as well as Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. I think those are really two really good books that give you a good idea of climate change and what it looks like, in particularly in communities of color.
Yeah, I, you know, PSRLA's website, we have a great report on air quality in South LA. We have a tool called the 500-foot tool that we're expanding that allows you to put your address in and shows you what polluting sources are within 500 feet of a home or a school. There's also the Climate Justice Alliance, which is climatejusticealliance.org, which has great materials on just transition, on false solutions. There's also Dr. Robert Bullard's website. He's the father of environmental justice. And I think that is a great place that has a lot of his, you know, information and history of the environmental justice movement and issues.
And I would like to add a couple more resources. The EWG, which is the Environmental Working Group, is another one that you can go on as a consumer to see about the products that you're using. It gives a score rating from 1 to 10. Ideally, you want to be under the 5 range. And so you can put the brand name in there, and it'll tell you some of the chemicals of interest to be, you know, looking at for concern. And that's a great resource. Also, there's the website, which is a clean beauty clearinghouse called Black and Green. And so it's a place where you can source, you know, personal care and menstrual care products, hair care products, all of that. And so that's a great resource. And then the Leaping Bunny, also looking at sustainability and, you know, green practices in terms of, you know, sourcing the products, the ingredients, the labor, which we talked about, making sure that that's as ethically sourced as well. And that is the Leaping Bunny website. And so another way that you can make sure that you're doing your part in being environmentally just.
I love this. It makes me want to run to my bathroom and throw out my 3-in-1 shampoo, conditioner, and body wash and go and get something that's more environmentally friendly, but also safer for me.
Yeah.
My girlfriend keeps telling me I need to do that, and you all convinced me that I gotta make it happen today.
So we didn't even touch on the issue of plastics, but that's for a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead? I mean, let's go ahead and touch on that before we close. I think that this is a big one because everybody tells you to recycle and that is somehow going to be the magic solution for our neighborhoods. But why don't you go ahead, Dr. Williams, tell us about plastics.
Yes, I'll just touch on the surface and I'll let Martha Dana continue on with this session. But I think it goes from even when the time of purchasing it. So you really need to see, you know, reduce your consumption of the products on the beginning. And so when you're talking about recycling, that's already after you used it and it's going back into the landfill and waste. So you just want to be mindful of the single use products that we use. And it would be you would be amazed in, you know, counting them throughout the day, whether it be a water bottle or that shampoo or conditioner. conditioner, you know, Tupperware, all of these are things where plastics are used. And so not only you're providing waste to our environment, the ecosystem, but you know, the toxins and chemicals that can be in there, such as BPA, which has been linked to a variety of different issues. And so yes, that is an issue in itself, is plastic. So reducing consumption of those and looking for greener options, perhaps, you know, glass or aluminum as alternative options in lieu of plastics.
Yes to all of that, but you know, plastics are made out of petroleum. And I think, you know, and I think that this reduce, reuse is a bit of a fallacy, because often most of the plastics we're producing can't be recycled. You don't want them to end up in landfill, and you don't want to burn them for energy, which is what some people are calling a green solution. So there's a lot of greenwashing or false claims about the solution to producing more plastic. But we're going to be doing a lot more work, and a lot of that work is going to be grounded in South LA, so that we can actually figure out what is a justice-based solution to the issue of plastics, from its production, its use, to its end of life. So we're going to be doing some fun things like focus groups with restaurant owners and to figure out what are some reusable options. But, you know, I have this fantasy that South LA will be the first place to open a zero waste market where, you know what, we do what we used to do in Nicaragua when I lived there in 86. If you wanted to buy something, you had to take a bottle to fill it up with, because it's not that sustainable, right? So there are zero waste markets where you take your own glass or non-plastic containers, you fill it with your flour, your sugar, your shampoo, whatever it is, the product. So we are not creating that, but it also is you end up spending more time, and it's a place of community. So there's so many benefits from thinking this, but we have to be creative. Like, we have to create the solutions for our communities that are based in these concepts of mutual aid, and that nobody's minding the store, and no one is going to be a fiercer advocate for our health than us, because, you know, we use a lot of plastic, right? Our communities, we don't trust our water, because water systems have failed us. So we use a lot of a lot of water bottles, and we think it's cheap, but it isn't really, because that little one bottle of water that may cost you a dollar, it actually costs so much more to dispose of. So don't get me started on plastics either.
Just to chime in on that, just the distrusting so of tap water and buying vented water, the quality invented, and a lot of studies has proved that there's still an equal number of chemicals, harmful chemicals, in those vended water bottles as well. But yeah, that's another conversation too.
Well, what should we drink?
Well, I would say if you're in DWP territory, you can more relatively safely drink your water. Your filters that are double, you know, reverse osmosis filters are pretty good. Even store-bought, you know, the kind you just put in a pitcher, those will work, but you should be checking your, it's not that simple, but you should check your water quality report to make sure that it's okay. But, you know, it depends on where you live and who brings you your water.
Yeah.
And oh, good to know.
Quality reports, there are different filters that will work for different things. Usually more natural ways that people are pushing is using charcoal to filter your water. That really only works for like bigger particles. So again, there's a lot of research that goes into that, and it is a lot of work. And it is unfortunate that that's placed on the communities that we just don't have access to clean water. But I guess in the interim, us as organizations, we try to provide that information to advocate in the interim while we make that push for that right to clean water.
I have to give out a big sigh, because it just seems like there's so many obstacles that South LA residents face on a daily to just live. I mean, the fact that a simple sip of water can cause you so much harm if you're not drinking from the right sources, it just seems like a lot. Before we close out, you know, as usual, we like to end on on the topic of action, on the topic of uplifting the good work that each of you are doing, your organization doing, and then countless others who are in this movement are doing. So I'm going to ask if there are any additional actionable initiatives or resources on top of everything that you've already given us today. Are there other ways that our listeners can get involved to fight for more sustainable ways of living, more environmental justice, and a better quality of life for us, our children, and our future generations?
Well, I think, I'm going to go back to something we said earlier as I close, is when I started doing this work 20 years ago, I used to hear elected officials from South LA say, our people don't care about that. That's not our biggest problem. And we managed to change that collectively, you know, between the work of PSR and Black Women for Wellness and Scope and many groups in South LA who said, no, that's not true. You need to start addressing environmental justice in South LA. And I think one demand is councilperson and demand that they vote yes on declaring oil and non-conforming land use in Los Angeles. That would be historic. That's one very local fight that's, I think, is incredibly important as part of this longer battle, this longer move of creating a just transition for South LA.
Thank you for that. Kayla?
I agree. I think as we have shifted the narrative that the traditional narrative of environmentalism, and we've kind of broken into that space and uplifted voices, I think that's our biggest means for change, is that we continue to use our voice and know that we are allowed to advocate for these things. And we have a rightful space in these conversations. I think cultivating our power, I think, is going to be the most important thing in providing the transition that we'd like to see.
Great. And Dr. Williams, if you close us out.
As it was mentioned, that oftentimes, minorities or people of color are not included in these discussions or don't have an opportunity to be able to advocate on their behalf. And so when the opportunity arises to be able to, go to the, city council, attend the town hall meetings, be able to, support the different bills. And there's a few that are, on the horizon right now, if we're talking about, the safer beauty bills and for protections against those that work in some of these industries. There, is a ban right now on the worst of the worst. So banning the 11 most toxic chemicals from beauty and personal care products. This is a package bill, so let me preface it with that. And so coming up on the horizon, we have these bills that are coming up. So just to close out, there's a bill that will be revealing about fragrance ingredients, which is another thing that we didn't talk about in most of your common products. Any product I would say that has a fragrance in it, whether it be, a shampoo or let's say, a cleaning product, right? And it has like, pine or, coconut or whatever, that comes at a cost or expense to your health in terms of the fragrance. And then protections for women of color and salon workers, which we've touched on. And then lastly, for supply chain transparency. So cosmetic companies can get information they need from upstream suppliers to be able to make safer products. And so again, just being able to advocate on the behalf of the consumers and for individuals.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for your time, for your knowledge, and more importantly, for your work. Our communities depend on it, our people depend on it, and our future depends on it. And we are incredibly indebted to you all for the great work that you are leading on behalf of everyone at the South LA Rooted team. We want to thank you for joining us today and for sharing all of these tremendous resources and powerful information with our listeners. And to all of you listening today, thank you so much. Please make check out the websites and the resources that we're sharing today. We'll make sure we put them on the link for the podcast so you can easily access those. Thank you so much for joining us. and for being a part of this movement.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest Digilab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.